SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From Clocker's Corner, Santa Anita Park, Arcadia, California, the great race place. A very good Thursday race fan, Sirius 162 XM 207 Sports Zone, 999 if you're listening to Sirius XM online, and at our website, stevebick.com, and crisp, I think, pretty morning from what I can tell. Looks like there's some haze over the mountains. They'll emerge quickly.
You can't even see the mountains.
I can see. I can see the. I see that. I see the what do you call
the
it?
Line.
The
no, that's
silhouette.
True. That's right. Every time
the silhouette.
They haven't taken the set down. That is
exactly.
That is real.
Hammer back with us, and the weekend is up in the air. Let's put it that way. At least locally, not going to have to worry about things at Hot Springs and at Hallandale. But I guess, Rick, they'll make a decision this morning about the Saturday card.
That's the word. They delayed the draw. It's an interesting situation when cards are questionable. It used to be, I know when I was here, you just draw the card, and then if there was a problem, you had to move it. You just took the card and moved it to wherever you wanted to move it. Now they want you to redraw them, so they're better off not even drawing them.
Right.
And then deciding, I mean, I'm just saying, let's just say they, for instance, wanted to move, if the weather continued and they didn't run on Saturday and they were able to run on Sunday, if they wanted to move the Saturday to Sunday, then they would do that and create the overnight for Sunday. But if they drew it for Saturday, they would have to redraw. And
but, pause for a second. What is the is it a jurisdictional decision? What is the, are there rules that apply to a redraw versus taking a card in its entirety and moving it to a different day? Because it seems like it's a fairly random set of parameters.
Well, I know in most states you can just take the card in its entirety
and move it wholesale.
And move it wholesale. See you later, done. I know we've done that here when I was here. And for stewards have a reason for that. They say it's a change of condition, so it's an entirely different situation, so you got to redraw.
Interesting.
They go, oh, you'll get more horses. No, it's not even that. It's just, the fields have been exposed, basically, and so now, we can handicap. Well, I'm not going back in there. I'm not the speed and all the other things. So it's just, it's better now to not even draw the race the day and wait and see, so you don't have to go through the redraw process.
Well, and especially if in fact they get an understanding that the majority of the weather might be over by 6 a.m. Saturday, and they'll know that they might only schedule one race on the turf. They may you may play around with your extras, right,
and
your
and
supplemental
so,
races.
But see, that's another thing here. So do the 6-7 day draws here as a rule sometimes the way the schedule does. So 3 days out, Wednesday for Saturday, it gives you the chance to look at the weather one day sooner and decide, like you said, this turf's not looking good, so maybe we try and substitute some other races. It just puts you closer to the event. I will say that years ago, weather was much more exaggerated, and I think more on a guessing game as far as if it was going to rain. I think in the last 3-4 years, they've really improved their able to tell what's going to happen more precise. And I don't know if it's just here or if it's everywhere, but used to be when it's going to rain, and it's like, that's 10 days away. What are you talking about? Now when they say rain 4 or 5 days away, they're pretty darn good.
Yeah,
I don't know if the equipment is better or the, because there's days when, we become weathermen and when you sit there and you look at it and you go, what are they talking about? This isn't going to be a big storm. And you're right, a lot of times. Now they pinpoint it. So if they can get today's forecast for the weekend 24 hours later than yesterday's, that gives another advantage, too, on deciding what races and how that goes. As you know, a little more sensitive here to weather in Southern California, both for training and for racing. And it's not an exact science, but they'll make a decision this morning based on the forecast. I got up and I put the local news on, which I like to do, and they went off on some story about a noodle contest in Hollywood or something down there this morning, some cooking show, and I'm waiting for some weather to go on, and I never saw it. So we'll go to our handy dandy phones and become weathermen and see what it looks like. But the last I heard last night was it was supposed to rain this weekend.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, because I'm not here on a daily basis and dealing with that situation. I'm not sure if there's a number. It has to do with sealing the racetrack, if they need to seal it on Friday night to get to Saturday, or Thursday night to get to Friday, then there's some rules in place about the timeliness running after a sealed track. So we'll wait and see.
We will, and we will we'll see what happens at that point. And, of course, one aspect on the Saturday, assuming a Saturday card is assembled, the coast-to-coast has potential, obviously, with the terrific card at Gulfstream to tie in. So that was actually how I even came to know early yesterday afternoon what was happening. And Brad Free then also updated everybody on it.
Yeah, they sent out a little thing on the coast-to-coast. And so you wonder if they could slip in a Golden Gate race or two to...
Oh, that's an interesting...
Keep the coast situation.
That's an interesting angle.
Actually, I just... Like this came to me a few seconds ago. I'm thinking coast. You got to have a coast. Well, Golden Gate's still going.
So. Well, and Laurel too. Actually, you could.
They're not on a. Well, they're kind of on.
They're
coast.
On a coast.
They are coasting to something.
Right? Do they have? They had. They had the two stakes last. They have no stakes this weekend. But So, in other words, there is the opportunity. I will mention that I know when we handicap tomorrow, when we talk to Nick, the sequence at Oaklawn is going to be part of that cross country, and very clever. It's an all stakes. It's the stakes sequence, the four straight at Oaklawn, and then they folded in the Excelsior at Aqueduct. So all stakes in New York and Hot Springs, the Excelsior, the Oaklawn Mile, the Matron, the Fantasy, and the Arkansas Derby. And I'm sure Nick Tamaro will provide a roadmap on that front.
And I looked at the weather in Hot Springs, and they
supposed
have
to be
77 and clear. And, you know, they deserve, if anybody deserves to have a dry weekend, it's Oaklawn Park. And so I'm glad it came on their big weekend. And like you mentioned, there are four stakes there rolling along. The Arkansas Derby came up pretty good, and we wish them a very good card. I mean, a very good weekend, and with the weather's nice there, that should bring them out. Where are we? We're late March, and that's about it. It's funny when my first year there, they tell you, oh, the weather, the weather gets great, you know, but just, you know, around first part of February, don't worry, it's going to be fine. Then after the third ice storm, you know, first part
March.
Just wait around, the blossoms will come out.
St. Patrick's Day,
and then, you know, the apple blossom goes, it's like, where are the blossoms you're talking about? And finally, right around the first part of April, it's like, well, and they tell me, we tell all the newcomers that, don't worry about it. And then, I mean, it could be, and I tell you what, I've been all over the place. I've lived all over the place, and weather, I'm not a big, weather doesn't bother me. I actually enjoy weather. I mean, different change, and I've never seen anything like it there, for, as far as tornadoes. That was the first time you hear about a tornado in some county, and I know that county's, you know, one county away, and you wake up and you know, unfortunately, there, you know, a couple buildings get demolished, and you look at the map and you go, oh my gosh, that's like 20 miles away. And so you start listening to that, and then the next day it's icy, then it's snowy, and got to park your car at the bottom of the hill because you can't drive it down because of the ice. And I mean, I kind of thrive on those kind of situations, but you get it all in Hot Springs, and they do a great job of ducking and dodging around it. And what I like there is, hey, if it's a non-race day and we can get things done by noon, guess what? We'll train from noon to 3 o'clock, and everyone's on the ready. It's not a big quote a big deal. They get their horses out at noon, and we'll tell you what date it's going to be tomorrow. And then when it's time to race, they're ready to run. So kudos to them and for doing that. But I'm glad that they're going to be rewarded with a good weekend starting on Saturday.
Well, a couple of things, and I got some news and notes I want to slip in, and then we'll also get into a visitor or two or more. They drew, as I look into the stack of paperwork, they drew, of course, after we finished with Dick yesterday, they drew the card at Maidan, and... There weren't PPs yet generated by the time I left this morning, but they will be soon enough, and I'm sure we'll talk to Marcus Hirsch tomorrow, and Marcus can explain to all of you why he missed the show last Friday.
Didn't have to do with the cat, did it?
No, he was in New Orleans.
That's all you need to know.
So draw your own conclusions. The World Cup, and of course the barrier draw, and the post and the saddlecloth are not the same. But field of 12 and Ushba, Tesoro, and Senior Buscador come together here, and you've also got Dermis Odagaki. You've got Defunded. Who's been operating over there? Krupe, with Luis Saez and Clapton. That's been pointing for this as well. Chad Summers, Dylan Davis over to ride, and Newgate, Zatori for Baffert. And as we were winding down, Bob Baffert. Got here, so I'm sure at some point we'll get, certainly next week at the very least, we'll talk to him, and who knows, very well could be a discussion about Newgate, but it feels like Ushba Tesoro, the horse to beat, coming in here. The Japanese contingent really very, very well positioned, it seems, on this card. Certainly the North American interest, as we mentioned yesterday, you got Sibelius, that is going to try to repeat in the Golden Shaheen.
Nakatomi and Haskins from here.
Yep.
Hopkins,
yep. Casa Creed in the Alquaz. You've got, the one thing we haven't really talked much about is the UAE Derby and... the situation with Forever Young. The interesting horse. It's going to get intriguing because Pantagate may not be so outlandish in this spot as it turns out. For all the quizzical aspect of considering sending Pantagate to Maidan to compete for Derby points may prove pretty clever by Christophe Clément. So we'll see. So we'll keep an eye on this, and I'll let Marcus do the handicapping for you tomorrow. And
was there what's going on with that name, Pantagate? I was trying to figure out. Was there a
Was situation there a, was with there the a Bears? Controversy
with the,
Panda?
The Bears? I don't know. I just
that's a good question. Actually.
I was reading that name the other. I was looking at the things last night. I go Pandagate. But yeah, odd, kind of an odd spot for Kristoff to send a horse, but for the 3-year-olds heading to the Derby. But hey, you never know. Hey, he's got a Derby contender on this continent, so
exactly with deterministic, right. Absolutely does
right. So that's rare to have one, but let alone him have two, pretty wild. And you know, only one horse in the turf, Catnip from Stidham, from over here,
yep.
Which
who apparently is turning heads in the mornings, from every report.
Yeah, good. You mentioned Newgate, of course, the winner here. We obviously hope he represents us well over there.
Well, you've also, and even though it doesn't have a North American bend to it, the Shima Classic came up very good with Rebel's Romance and August Rodin and Emily Upjohn, etc., and more. Junko in here for Andre Favre with Maxime Guillon. Shahryar, Fujiwara with Christian DeMuro. So there's a lot going on this card. It's always a fun way to wade into the Florida Derby action. And, of course, the last few years when Oaklawn made the move from 3 weeks lead up to Derby to 5 weeks, a very interesting maneuver. And so it's made this, you know, last Saturday in March become even bigger. And it's actually appropriate. Spreads things out.
I think this might be the third year that happened, that they moved.
Feels like that. It feels about right.
You know, when they stretched out the dates from the little 2.5 month meeting to starting in December and going all the way to May, they stretched out the schedule a little bit, and that was an obvious move. They had a kind of a neat spot running 3 weeks out, which gave horses that, you know, had a little bit of an ailment earlier, and they always had a spot to drop into as the last minute they could get into the Arkansas Derby. But 3 weeks is like, ooh, I can't run back in 3 weeks. So they've gone moderate and gone to the 5 week slot.
Well, and it's funny because the 3 weeks, and of course the Lexington is now the lone 3 week lead up race that's available, and more thought of as a move toward Preakness. And I mean, there was that period, Baffert in particular, there was that period where the Arkansas Derby was an absolute springboard into Derby.
Well,
successfully.
I'll tell you, I'm going to say probably 15 years ago now, maybe a tad longer. You know, the San Anita Derby was a month out, and I think at that time there might have been three races on that day. Three.
Well, the Bluegrass, the Wood,
and the San Anita Derby.
They were always together.
So looking to do something, I was thinking, you know, maybe this needs to move, talking about the San Anita Derby. And, yeah, forward, backward, backward, forward, but mostly going forward to 3 weeks out. And I called 3-year-old trainers and asked them, obviously, I'm not just going to say, hey, let's change it. And I got an interesting reaction because I didn't know what it would be. And I'm talking to the Todds in the world, and I probably talked to Bobby Frankel and Bob, and it's like, you know what? The 3 week period, here was their thing. Was once I get my, it's like, yes, we like that, because once I get my horse ready, I don't want to wait that long. I want to, boom, he's ready to go. Let's get him back into a race quick, rather than, you know, having to train him and, you know, things could go a little awry the longer you're waiting and some little things. So when they were 3 weeks out, I was actually kind of thought I'd get a little pushback, and their consensus was, you know what, 3 weeks is great because, like I said, my horse is doing good. Let's get him back into a race quick. You know, kind of passing it around here with some of the higher-ups, it didn't make it past the next level, so I abandoned it. But I always remember the saying that, like, yes, we're good, let's go now, rather than the waits. And it is kind of a we kind of wait on pins and needles as fans, you know, that last week of Derby, because you know some little thing's going to happen here, and a little thing happens here, and a little thing happens here every year, and we lose two or three horses in that last 10-day period. And so I always think back to that, those discussions I had with those guys. So it was something to the 3 weeks. And like you said, Arkansas had a run there where, I mean, that was the spot to go. That was the prep race. It seemed like it made the round. Santa Anita had a good run. Florida had a good run. And Arkansas had a good run. Who knows why, but...
Well, and you had a period where, I mean, Smarty Jones, you go back to 2004, Smarty Jones, Fleet Alex, who very easily could have won the Derby, Lawyer Ron, Curlin, Gallego, Papa Clem, and that's some of that cackling is Gary up there, is Gary Studi, Lina David, Arch, who of course got hurt with that one hole, Bodie Meister, who could have led both the Derby and Preakness deep into the races, only to be collared. Overanalyzed, Danza, American Pharoah, 2015, Creator, which produced one of the great photos of all time, Asmussen holding the trophy and Dale. The photo I took of them on the backstretch after the race, which was hysterical. Classic Empire, Magnum Moon, the ill-fated Magnum Moon, Omaha Beach, Charlatan, Nadal, Superstock, Cyberknife, who had a terrible Derby but recovered thereafter, Angel of Empire, who had a very good third in the Derby. So there you go. I want to slip this in, Rick, if we could. Dan Hall from Hidden Brook is going to join us, and I was sort of vamping and waiting till I had a definitive opportunity. For those that had not seen it, and I don't think it's been widespread, but Frieda Stronach passed away yesterday, and an absolute wonderful champion of aftercare and basically looking after horses, and what she established at Edina. While Dan Hall was managing the farm, it was really special. She basically pledged to look after every single horse that Edina Springs bred. Dan Hall joins us. Dan, I appreciate this, and Mrs. Stronach, very private, but somebody that the public should know was invaluable to the era of aftercare that we're in right now.
Yes, she was. The whole family really—they made a pledge to look after theirs, and created a whole division down at the Florida farm, strictly for those retired horses. She was a great champion of that.
She put out, I remember her putting out basically a missive that it didn't matter what the situation was. If you had an Edina horse that was in, that ended up with you, whether you bought it at auction, whether you claimed it somewhere down the line, if you needed to, end their racing career, that Edina would take them back, and that was innovative when it happened. There really wasn't a cohesive or cogent plan that breeders that a commercial breeder operation was offering like that.
Right. No, that's true, and that was just a testament to the kind of person that she was, whether it be the horses or humans, in all the years managing the farm, spoke with Frieda probably more than anybody, to be honest with you, and not always about getting decisions, but just talking about the horses. She loved to hear about them. Always asked about your family, just a true lady.
Well, and certainly wasn't very public per se, and I mean, she might even be embarrassed that we're doing this to pay tribute, but I didn't want the morning to go without a proper acknowledgement, because she loved horses the way Frank loves horses.
Exactly. And you're right, she wasn't a public person. But I think she'd be proud that we're talking this way about her right now.
Thoughts out to Frank, and they were married 60 plus years, I believe, in that range. So thoughts to Frank, to Andy as well, and Belinda. My father was also Austrian, so I'll say to their Mutti, as we called my father's mother affectionately. Dan, I appreciate the opportunity, and at some point I'd love to talk with you, about Hidden Brook, with one of our other mutual friends, the late Paul Pompa. Another we could talk glowingly. We always talk glowingly whenever whenever Paul's. They're still out there running, the Pompas.
Yeah, no, sure. Be happy to, and appreciate the opportunity to speak about Frida this morning.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Hall from Hidden Brook, as we say goodbye and pay tribute to Frida Stronach, and from a little tiny town in Austria.
Yeah. Condolences to the Stronach family. Yeah. I never had the pleasure to meet Mrs. Stronach.
I met her
over the years. I heard nothing but never heard anything but good things about her.
Yeah.
And heard that news this morning as well.
Yeah. Other piece of news, and we are going to have Adam Koenig join us because. We need some political expertise to discuss this this sort of reformatting of the KHRC and how the state essentially is going to manage the regulation of gaming and of racing in particular. So rather than me. Rather than me tap dance around.
I saw they're going to create a separate commission, but a group that they have like for the lottery that's going to handle racing, the slot machines, and sports betting. And so just be a little more concentrated on that rather than be just part of a big agenda. So it'd be interesting to hear like right from the source here, like you said, how it's going to happen. I guess it's good.
Well, we'll find out. Adam joins us. Adam, good morning.
Good morning. Morning, Hammer.
Good morning, Adam. Good. Like I said, we can stop the speculation here and go right to the source. I was trying to think about it in my head last night. I was reading a couple articles on it, how that was going to work, and I said, I think that's good.
I think so, too.
Now, explain the concept and why Damon floated this and thought it was a potential improvement.
Sure. Well, actually, Damon, his goal was to get the Racing Commission out from under the Public Protection Cabinet and, frankly, make it less political. And his initial bill moved it under the Department of Agriculture, and the Speaker of the House, David Osborne, also a horse person, owns a farm and once had a runner in the Breeders' Cup Classic. He went to Damon, as I understand it, and said, "Hey, here, have this other idea." And I think part of it was generated from a bill I had for a couple of years to create a gaming control board like they have in Nevada and Pennsylvania and a few other states where everything gaming is housed under one roof. Speaker Osborne suggested that they kind of create an independent commission, which is what the way our lottery is designed. They would be attached to that same cabinet for administrative purposes, but effectively be out from underneath the day-to-day pressures of having to go to a cabinet secretary to be allowed to do certain things. And I think the best example of why it's good is in my bill in 2022 that overhauled our parimutuel laws and, among other things, created penny breakage. I increased the daily fee on per machine for HHR, and because it was like $9 a month, which is not enough to regulate it properly. And I think I tripled it, which is probably still not enough, but that's another discussion. And it goes in what's called a restricted fund, so that it can only be spent for that. But then it's up to the administration to actually spend it. And apparently the administration of Governor Beshear wouldn't let that money go. And so it didn't change anything other than build up money in that fund. This, when the Racing Commission is an independent entity, any restricted funds will be able to be spent by the board for its intended purpose rather than be subject to administration and politics, frankly. And it doesn't, I'm not picking on Governor Beshear. This would go for any governor who, wants to play around with things. So it works for our lottery. They're also going to move charitable gaming underneath and into this new entity. All the current Racing Commission board members will be on there for at least another 2 years. The governor will still appoint those people, but then they will be free to basically, you know, operate the entity as it should be operated.
What kind of terms for the
They are going to basically give everyone who's currently on the Racing Commission 2 years to keep the continuity going. And I don't think, you know, Senator Thayer said during the committee hearing the other day that he's happy with the board and he likes everyone and he's not trying to get anybody kicked off. So, and then there will be new appointments beginning after 2 years. And, you know, that means Governor Beshear will be able to appoint some, if not all, of them as in his basically his final year in office. So there'll still be plenty of continuity. I think that when you're looking at issues of HHR, gray machines, responsible gaming, it's time for us to start looking at everything in a holistic manner. Right now, the only entity paying into, sports betting's in there too, I forgot. If you're looking at things in a holistic manner, right now, the only people paying into problem gaming fund is sports betting. That, frankly, doesn't make any sense. So I think they'll be able to look at things in a broader, more comprehensive fashion that will benefit all the facets of gaming in Kentucky.
Well, and I suppose, and I know Matt Hegarty, referred to Heiss's administration and some of the regulatory responsibilities that shift in that direction and away from a state racing commission. Potentially, what responsibilities will be, from what you can tell, Adam, what responsibilities in terms of regulating racing specifically, the stewards, steward administration, what else is going to be under their arm?
I don't think there's going to be anything that they're doing now that's going to change. Okay. It's just the administration the technical aspects of how the board is comprised and who they're attached to. I mean, it's inside government baseball, but I think the end result will be, and certainly the intention of the end result will be, that they will be less politics will be less a factor, and they will be more of a freestanding organization that can do what they need to do without people getting involved. And let's face it, I mean, if there's ever going to be a anti-gaming governor, as the way politics are right now, it's going to be from the Republican Party, which is my party. And so if it's independent, then you know, I think that's a long-term good thing for horse racing.
So, Adam, it sounds like that group's going to be a lot less encumbered to get things done. If they need to call a meeting, they can just call it without going through.
Exactly. I mean, that can be done. And look, right now we have a Democrat governor, Republican legislature. They don't get along very well, unfortunately. And, from my experience and from what I'm hearing from my friends, it's a two-way street. I mean, there are, departments that are just not allowed to talk to legislators. That's unfortunate. And obviously there are legislators that regularly take shots at the administration, and that's unfortunate too. In this case, they'll be able to operate in a manner that benefits everyone, I think.
All right. This bubbled to the surface, the last couple of days, and, appreciated you, offering up an explainer for those that were watching. Separately, I see that the quarter horse activities continue, and catch everybody up on what has become a really pleasurable role.
It has been. For those that don't know, I represent the Quarter Horse Racing Association, the Horsemen, we just finished our 6-day meet, which was at Red Mile. We finished it on Tuesday. We had great weather the first 5 days. Tuesday was very rainy and windy, but numbers were great. Well received, first of all the horses for the second year in a row that went out to race. All came back. As far as I know, they're all healthy. Had no drug issues. We had one last year. We've had no issues with illegal activity with drugs this year, which is great. Our handle was up, I think, over 25%. We filled more races and had something like 30% increase in horses that run per race. Everyone seems to enjoy it. Our purses were, I talked to multiple trainers who came up from Louisiana because our purses are about 50% higher. And with the opening of the HHR machine facility in Ashland, and they're looking to put in their extension, hopefully within the next year, that'll continue that way. Everything so far is pointing up, and as we're starting to say around here, they're closing tracks in other parts of the country, and we're building them in Kentucky.
Adam, is there a gap in a schedule somewhere that you can fit in a 30-day meet type of thing? Is that what you're looking to do?
When the track is built at Ashland, and we're hoping to go out there next year, but it's going to be tight, so maybe one more year at Red Mile, we'll see. But, obviously the amount of money that we raise from the historical horse racing machines will determine how many days we can run. Myself and the track operator, Sandy's Racing and Gaming, are working on figuring out where we fit into that schedule, what kind of niche we want to fill. I think we'll be looking at running later and maybe having, you know, a couple days every couple weeks for an extended period of time. Maybe it'll be 12, maybe it'll be 18, maybe it'll be 30 if we generate enough money. We'll see. But, I think we have the potential of probably, you know, are we ever going to compete with Ruidoso? Probably not. But I think we have the potential of being the best program east of the Mississippi and one of the leading programs, hopefully, in the country. That's certainly the goal.
So, as a pretty good geographer, I don't know exactly where Ashland is. Can you where is Ashland located?
Ashland is on I-64 in the far east, and it borders up against West Virginia.
Okay.
It's coal country.
Coal country, not far. Yeah, Appalachia, not far away, probably 30, 40 miles from Charleston. Very close to Huntington.
Down the Ohio River.
I see it now.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
Yep.
I couldn't.
It's, I mean, I'm not sure they run quarters east of there in America.
I don't think they do, at least legally, anyway.
There's that.
There might be some wagering going on, over there, but you just quarter horses and Kentucky. Well, it's horse racing, so I guess it fits into the Kentucky realm. But hey, why not, right?
Absolutely. We put up a table this year. We had obviously plenty of people who heard about it and just came out to check it out, and a lot of people interested in asking about the breeding program, which is part of obviously the goal. The incentive program will be lucrative and even have some well-known thoroughbred farms sniffing around to find out if it might be worth having a few quarter horse mares. And as many of your listeners know, I'm sure you can breed thoroughbreds to quarter horses. So there's some overlap there.
Very much so. And the guy to talk to about that is Steve Asmussen. Asmussen can give you some insight.
Asmussen had he was the trainer of record for one horse in our meet.
Of course he was.
And he came in second.
He
got well bet.
No, it's that actually is, you know what, that's a fun topic. It comes up every so often with Sid, and there's been some very notable over the years. There's been some notable thoroughbred stallions that got quarter horses, and thoroughbred stallions that got famous polo ponies as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's some of that.
I'm learning and. Yeah, apparently you can't just cross all that well with any thoroughbred stallion. They were pushing Hog Creek Hustle. I guess there was ads all over for Hog Creek Hustle to be a stallion in this area. And we actually had a horse that the stallion was into mischief run, and he did not do so well. So. That may not be the way to go, I guess, but
I love it. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to catch up, and I knew when you were going to give everybody an idea about this new, this new structure for Kentucky, that I would let you tell everybody about where the quarter program is headed. So I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, and. Yeah, just check out Kentucky Quarter Horse Racing Association. If you got any questions, I'll answer your email.
Perfect. Adam Koenig, everybody. And Adam, I'm going to assume you were Jeff Ruby Day. That's one of your favorites.
I actually was not. I'm waiting for you to get back down here.
All right. It'll just a few weeks away now, actually. I'll be there in 2.5 weeks.
I can assure everyone I will be at at the Bluegrass Day for those that care, which is a very small universe of people. But
that's not true. You've been a tremendous friend to racing interests, and everything that transpired in Kentucky with the acceptance and the codifying of HHR in Kentucky has got your thumbprints all over it. Wouldn't have happened without you. And so all the success that
Betty Breakage is taking off.
Oh, that too.
Let's coin that with that. Put an exclamation mark behind the Penny Breakage because that was huge. And we've expanded to
Emerald, Washington.
We're going in. Is it Colorado? No, they're doing the fixed odds. But there's absolutely no reason why every racing jurisdiction should not have Penny Breakage. I don't know. I'm glad you cracked that egg, and hopefully others will follow.
Well, thanks. I'm glad Patrick Cummings gave me the idea.
He's got a lot of them.
Adam, I appreciate the chance to catch up, and we'll see you in a few weeks.
Anytime. Thanks.
Adam Koenig, explanation of what's happening in Kentucky with this amendment or this new structure.
Anytime you can get as much politics out of anything is good, and it sounds like they're going to have a little independent group to maybe do what they want. Now, Steve, we're sitting out here this morning, and it's one of those mornings where it wasn't – you could see the mountains when you got here.
It's crazy.
And so this is one of those mornings that if you grew up and you didn't be a racetrack and you were reading a book, and then they talked about the getting a horse out in the early morning in the fog and working without anybody seeing it, this is one of those days. As the track just opened up from its first break, and – the guys that wanted to get the works in came out quick, and we're sitting here and we watched them come out, and we saw half a dozen horses get their works in on the rail, knowing that there was nobody around, and not less horses on the track. But this is one of those mysterious mornings you hear about. Ooh, I wonder if that horse got the work in the fog and they didn't catch it, and things like that. So this is days like this are what make, I don't know, this is so special, just being out here in the morning, just watching the horses go by, and this is where it happens.
I've got a picture from a Breeders' Cup when the fog rolled in, and it was earlier in the morning. At least here, you've got some light that, you know, is filtering through. The picture I took, and it was Halloween, as it happens, because it was leading up to Breeders' Cup, and it was so eerie, and I was down, I was right down here, sort of below the rail, and a horse was coming off, and I took a picture looking up at it, so it's a foggy silhouette of the horse. I'll try to find that. I have put it up subsequently over the years in
pool money
for the basketball
donation
pool.
Donation. Yeah,
that's right, donations. So that it has that feel to it, but this will burn off pretty quickly, won't it?
Oh yeah, I mean it's actually odd for it to come back unless there's a pocket here. But like I've said, now you literally cannot see the mountains, and you can barely see from the outside rail to the inside rail, and if you look at the top of the stretch, you cannot see a horse coming. So this is like pretty cool. And of course, like with anything, when you're in it and you're on the track, you can see a lot better. So this is where these guys are on the track. Of course, there's horses on the fence going what we call the right way, and horses in the middle going at a 2 minute clip-ish or galloping down the middle of the track, and then the horses that are coming back to the barn are on the outside going the wrong way. So very well regimented, and you need to do that in the deal. And I'm going to say about one of every third riders has a little, I would call it a minor light, some kind of a light on their helmet. So not necessarily for them to see, but for others to see them. And this is it. So this is why we like to invite people out here to Clocker's Corner or any racetrack and watch what goes on in the mornings. This is a special type of morning.
Well, and you and I have talked about it over the years too. The whole clocking concept. California, for whatever reason, had this culture, and you know, not that it's not done in the East, but it's not. You know, you had all the clocking reports in particular it just seems like California, you know, established that, you know, that concept of reports. Then, of course, the videos started, and a lot of that boiled out of the works shows. The TVG started leading up to Breeders' Cups and Derbies, and HRTV, which you know then morphed into XBTV. But the clocker culture, you come here, you know, at Los Al. When I go to Los Al in December, they've got that little restaurant of theirs that, you know, overlooks the track.
Oh yeah, no.
And that's a vibrant setting as well.
Well, I'm going to say clocking in general has been very, I think, more regulated here than I've seen at other places. Not that other places aren't, but I mean, tell you what, they're going to find out who that horse in the red jacket was that went by. They'll hunt it down and find out and make sure that time gets in there. So I think that probably spurred some of the private clockers doing their thing and, you know, putting out sheets and all that stuff. But because times here, it's a big deal. And you try and put the wrong horse out there, you know, switch saddle towels or, you know, all kinds of the stuff. Of course, it gets by. You know,
hijinks.
Hijinks. Boy, that was a big deal. You know what happened? Oh, yeah, put on the wrong saddle towel. Got to. I mean, I'm sure that stuff, went on a little bit more frequently years ago. But clocking means a lot here. So when you see a time in the form, I mean, from here, not that I'm not putting down any other areas. I'm saying it's right. And verified by the private clockers as well in their report. So,
well, we're still also waiting for the, you know, what may be, what may prove to be a, you know, an additional new era in clocking, which will, I was going to have you come sit down too. How you doing? Come sit down rather than stand there. Vince DeGregory, who I didn't get a chance, Hammer, the last couple of mornings to mention where Vince, you know, because Vince wasn't out the last couple of mornings. Well, here. No, I got it here. It's fine. I there. That's all I got to do. Just take the briefcase off the chair and you get that one. I Vince DeGregory joins us, and
Vince got some stories about working horses in the fog. If anybody does, I'll tell you.
Well, and Vince, I wondered the last couple of mornings. Vince isn't out here yet, so I wondered when you were going to turn up.
I'm here every day, but Tuesday when there's no racing.
Yeah, it's light. That's right.
No workouts in the morning, but joggers, I take a day off.
Why not?
At the hell, August, I'll be 92 years of age, and every time I see you, it reminds me of where I was born in Greenwich, New York, and
it's unbelievable.
To think that you lived there all of these years, and that was a young kid. I loved Greenwich, and it was just the good times of my life. But as you get older, and you start traveling around the world, and you still miss where you were born and your upbringing, and jealous of you being there with your wife and you live not far from Wally's.
You bet.
I mean, that does bring back great memories for me.
Well, and you got to go back, you know, for a long time, but come back for Saratoga seasons.
Saratoga has been, how can I say, the greatest thrill in my life. Being an athlete when I was a young kid, and I was 16 years old, and I didn't know Ralph Thurl at all, who he was, and my name was in the New York Daily News with Gene Ward column about the Dodgers were scouting me at the time. And Ralph Thurl called and he introduced himself to me, said he was the agent for Billy Bolden, who had just won the Kentucky Derby at that time, and asked me if I was interested in playing in a summer league, playing softball. I said, why not? And that's how I got started on the racetrack when I was 16. To think now that I'm going to hit 92, where did all the time go?
That's Ralphie's father.
And all of the great times that I had, the chance to meet so many wonderful people in my life, travel halfway around the world and see the greatest horses of all time running. And you mentioned them, and I've seen them run. And everybody always asks me the same question all the time. Of all the horses you've seen, well, it's kind of hard to pick one from another in different eras. But I remember as a young agent, everything was based on handicaps. How much weight can a horse carry?
Sure.
How far can he go? And that's how they judge on how great the horses were. Well, I remember I was a Pinkerton in Saratoga, and they had a match race supposedly was going to take place. Albert Vanderbilt had the Native Dancer, and Mrs. Payson had Tom Fool. Now, my job in the paddock was to make sure the crowd didn't get near the two as they were schooling the day before they're supposed to run. In come this big, great, holy, look at this time of gun. In comes this little midget, Tom Fool. Holy shit, this guy's winning all the races. How can that be? Well, cut a long story short, the next day, Mr. Vanderbilt chickened out. He wouldn't run in the match race against Tom Fool. They were going a mile and a quarter. And that's my memory of two great horses in those days. And then to be around Tom Fool as a little horse, and then I see this big, ugly horse called the one and only that Eddie Arkell said was the greatest horse that he ever. And he was five-time horse of the year, Kelso. And I had the opportunity to be around the barn with him. He was nasty. He was, that's why they yelled at him. I guess he was just ornery, but he was a great racehorse. So, I mean, Buddy Delpet, spectacular bid. I mean, I've seen them all run. So I gave my opinion. People get mad at me. You don't know what you're talking about. Okay, fine.
That's okay. How can nobody, you know, nobody can question you know, that kind of a, you know, of an opinion. I mean, it's subjective.
Five-time horse of the year.
Yeah.
And he carried 135, 136. And I can tell you one little story about that. Eddie Arkell used to rent my dad's home in Saratoga. So I wasn't even an agent at the time. But I happened to be in the house. And he got a phone call. And I don't know who's on the other end of the line. All I heard Willie Horn say, Eddie, you got a phone call. So I can't decipher who's on the other end. And it's got quiet. And all of a sudden, I heard him get mad. He said, God damn it, I'll tell you how good he is, but I ain't going to let you find out. Who the hell is he talking about? So he finally hung up. He said, can you imagine that silly so-and-so? She wants to know how good Kelso is. I've been holding him back so that the handicappers don't put two or three more pounds on. And she wants me to let him run. That was Mrs. DuPont. I almost fell out of the chair. But that's a story in itself.
That's so great. I love that.
How great he was. He was running the whole show. He'd call Shoemaker. Shoe would fly in from California, go by the house, and she would say, listen, I'm going to retire. I'm going to put you on Kelso. So he did put him on Kelso. And, of course, Shoe won on him, and he had his life and death. And he said to Eddie, I don't want to ride him anymore. That horse is so old, and it's all dead weight. I don't weigh nothing. Got 30 pounds of lead on there. He needs some old young guy that can really be aggressive with him. And that's how Eddie put Milo Venom's a wheeler on.
Interesting. Yeah. And you know, and that, as is always the case, when Vince DeGregory joins us, one comment or one suggestion, you know, leads to other questions. You talk about dead weight. Mm-hmm. And how a lot of trainers would prefer, right? Would prefer live weight,
correct,
as opposed to dead weight. Explain what we mean by dead weight and live weight.
Well, dead weight is that the lead is on there, and a live weight is down in the last 20 yards when that horse is getting lazy and he's getting tired. You got to pick him up. You got to have an aggressive jock on there that can get after him and make him extend himself right at the wire to win the photo finishes. And I understood what Shoemaker meant. He said, there's so much dead weight on this horse, I can't help him. I weigh 90-some pounds. I can't be aggressive at the wire. And he took himself off Kelso. And that's how Marlon Bonds
put a heavier, put a when we say live weight,
correct,
we mean a jock that physically weighs more and doesn't have to rely on the weight pads.
And that's was so beneficial. And Mr. Hamlin being a racing secretary,
we just talked about this.
His hand was, I can't put more weight on horses because they won't run, and therefore we lost all the great horses. And so today we don't have a handicap division. Only because of the fact horse racing has changed so much to the fact that when the horses are 3 and 4 and they're champions, they put them in stud. They don't want to take an opportunity as 5 and 6 years old. So the game has changed so much. And it's sad for me, I guess, being envious of the fact that when I used to come to the racetrack, either here in California or in New York, there'd be 25,000 people during the week, 50,000 on the weekend, and the excitement. Everybody who was everybody in sports, all the baseball players, football, all get an opportunity, come to the racetrack. They want to see the jockeys and the horses run. And then to think about how situations have transpired. We've lost so many racetracks, and it's so sad because it's all based on money, that when them people made all the money when they closed those tracks down and put apartment complexes up, and they died, they took their money, they can't take it with them, but they deprived the younger generation of the opportunity to come to the racetrack, see the horses and the jockeys, and be there with the thrill of the game itself. So that's the only thing that I feel badly about, that the kids today are never going to get that opportunity.
And you know, and in some cases, when it comes to this, and you know, the loss of racetracks, it's not just limited. You know, people think, oh, you know, because the game's not as popular. It's not limited to that equation. One of the things that happened was racetracks were built on outskirts, originally on outskirts of communities cities. And cities,
right.
And those cities grew out over and essentially the property that was, you know, cheap at the time when the tracks were founded,
mm-hmm,
became that much more valuable because of the growth of the municipality around it.
Yes.
And it just, I mean, that's something that, you know, that happens. So that's part of that equation. What, in fact, Vince, there's another great question for you to field. Talk about some of your favorite places that, you know, that are gone, and you know, the people, you know, even, I mean, I'm 64, and, you know, even people my age didn't get a chance, you know, to see the Hazel Parks and the DRCs and Caliente and the like.
Or just think in California, Bay Meadows was an outstanding racetrack itself. Everybody used to like to go there. They had big handicap races.
A historic track, too.
And we lost them. And then we lost a little track like Pomona. I mean, all the racetrackers love to go to Pomona to meet the people that are suffering on the small racetrack. We'd all get together for 2 weeks and enjoy the fair situation with the mules running and all the different types of atmosphere that you'd have just for the congregation of people struggling, not making a lot of money. They're just as happy as the ones here at the big tracks making a lot of money, that they love horse racing that much. And then what else can I say? I worked in Garden State for many, many years. Kenny Noe was the racing secretary there then, and I was an aspiring agent, and I was working my fanny off, didn't make a lot of money. And God bless Kenny Noe. He called me in his office one day. He said, Vince, I've been watching you, how you handle yourself, or how you handle the jockeys, and I'm going to teach you how to have a winner's book. I didn't know what a winner's book was, and then he explained it to me. In those days, we had a classified division here in California and in New York. They put the A horses and the classified horses. There'd be certain races in the condition book. 9 winners of a race of 8,500 6 months ago. Well, we didn't have computers available at that time. So if you didn't keep records of each horse when he won, how much he won each individually, short, long, turf, dirt, well, he taught me how to do that. And so when I finally got a jock in demand, 1966, Eddie Arcaro told me about Angel Cordero. Nobody knew who Angel was. He just got to New York. And Eddie Belmonte was my good friend, brought him there. And he introduced me to Angel, and that's how I became his agent. But as it turned out, by what Kenny Noe taught me about that winner's book, I would keep one here in California and one for New York. So when I'd go to New York with Pinkay, I got to beat Cordero. I got to know where them horses belong. So anytime I did it, Rick, I could break up all those races. I would know every horse that belonged in the races. And I can tell you one little story. Angel, I love Angel to death, but I had to beat him. So I'm doing the books, and this horse stood out to me. I don't know who the trainer is. And all of a sudden, I said, I'm going to go buy that guy's barn tomorrow. So I go by the barn. I introduce myself to this trainer. I said, so I'm the agent for Lafitte Pinkay. I said, you know, well, Lafitte didn't know one horse from the other. I said, so Lafitte really likes it. Your horse, he saw him run the other day. He just got beat with Cordero. And he said to me, oh, I like that jockey Pinkay. I said, sure like to ride that horse. He said, well, there's no race in the condition book, but maybe the next book. So I said to him, listen, I'm going to go to the racing office. I'll be right back. I'm going to see if he's eligible to that race. I knew he was. He said, okay, you go find out. So I go around the barn. I come back. I said, he's okay to run in there. He's okay, you mark the race. Now the overnight comes out, and I see Cordero. I said to him, Angel, who the hell is this trainer? I don't even know this horse. He looked. He said, what? He said, I've been riding that horse. I said, I don't know the guy. He came and saw me this morning. So, cut a long story short, because I was doing that book, the winner's book, and the horse went by many. The next day he saw me, he said, I should have known you got me. But that's the idea of that winner's book.
But that's what separated back then. That's what separated the good agents from the big deal. And think about it. In the racing office, in California, not so much. Because you had California, you had Santa Anita's and maybe Bay Meadows and Golden Gate that you would keep track of.
New York, we had the whole surrounding.
We go back, when I'm back down Monmouth Park.
Monmouth Garden State.
My gosh, you got that, the big form. Remember the big form?
Yes,
it was
big
huge.
Morning like a, Telegraph.
Yeah, but it wasn't
big,
the small,
the
small version.
We have here.
And you would have to go through there and write down all the winners at Delaware, Penn National, Laurel.
Every day I did that.
And keep track of them. Because
in that book.
When you wanted to write a race.
That's correct.
You had to know who was eligible.
I knew who was eligible. To that particular race.
And what money to use and what
and then
date
I broke
to
it
use.
Down, you know, yeah. Rick, so I had a better idea. If I didn't do that, I thank Tenny Noel because eventually he became the race secretary in New York, and I had Pinkay at that time, and he called me in the office. He said, I see you know how to use that winner's book. I said, without that, I would have been in a lot of trouble. But that was the idea in those days. Now we don't have anything like that. No more winner's book. They used to print the sheet out every week. And put the names of the horses. So if you're keeping records, you just pull the horse up and see how much he earned. Then you know if he's eligible. Then you've been watching horses. Then I was keeping charts. Back in the form, I would paste it every day. Not today. You don't have to do that. Everything's, the computer age is fantastic. To be a jockey agent today, it's a snap. In my days, if you didn't take and keep charts and knew where horses belong, it's a guessing match. But today, you can usually tell who's going to run in those particular races. That's the way it is. That was the joy of me being a young agent. I didn't know much. And when Kenny Noel called me in, and he enlightened my life, and I'll never forget that.
I was going to say, take that just to a different level with handicappers.
Correct.
And the edges that they... certain handicappers had are gone now because information is known everywhere.
Yep.
Where if you had a little tidbit, you might have seen a horse working a fog, to speak. Well, now everybody announces it, puts it on Twitter.
Totally
hey, to see that work.
Yep.
Where you could have.
I agree. The racing in the younger days was outstanding. I mean, the horses today, there's outstanding horses as well. But it just seemed that in my time, those horses, I think, if they were here today against the younger generation, I think they would beat these horses.
Well, and that was going to be one of the follow-up question I was going to ask.
That's
you.
That's my opinion.
Well, I was going to say, in other sports, there's that discussion about, for instance, Babe Ruth. You know, people say, Babe Ruth wouldn't be what he is now. What he was, first of all, I disagree that I mean, under the conditioning and under the elements, you know, a guy like that and Gehrig and virtually all those, you know, the first 50 years of the century, those guys would have adjusted to the equipment.
I agree. You know,
they talk about the Tiger Woods. If you gave Ben Hogan the golf balls of today and those equipment of today,
yeah.
Ben Hogan would whip their ass eight ways from Sunday.
100%.
Hockey is another example.
Yep.
If Gordie Howe could use a fiberglass stick with a banana blade to lift pucks at any portion of a goal, they would need computers to keep track of how many goals he scored. It's preposterous to think that, you know, that
everything is elevated because of modern times, modern equipment, and in my situation when I played ball, I'm in service playing with Dick Grote, who was the captain of the Pirates, and we played basketball for Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and I didn't train like him. He was a fanatic, and I had to guard him in basketball practice, and he'd run me ragged. And then I'd be done, I'd be happy. I'm dressed, and I'm looking, there he is taking 100 jump shots, 100 foul shots. I said, man, what, you know, it's time to go home. He said, there's a difference of being great and being average. You want to be average, but I want to be great. And that's what he did. As a young athlete,
from that perspective, as opposed to the horses, and you know, horses are funny because thoroughbred horses have not gotten faster, even with better nutrition and anything else.
Much better fed today.
They're the same. That's one athlete that cannot seem to break through to the next level. And people say, oh well, the standard breds are pulling sulkies that weigh 3 ounces compared to what they were to what Dan Patch dragged around.
No doubt about it.
But among the jocks. Among the jocks, I mean, who from prior eras would have? I mean, obviously the great Hall of Famers and the elite. You mentioned Chu and Arcaro, but you know, talk about some jocks, Vince, that are you know, that either got too tall, they got too heavy, they didn't get a chance to, you know, to have full careers.
Most of them that had weight problems never got an opportunity, because in my days and I started as an agent in '59 and. Weight consciousness was so prevalent in those days. If you were 2 pounds over, they didn't care if you were broad, you by Azer, or your Lafitte Pinquet. They're going to put a jock on that can do that weight. They were so much weight conscious, and the owners and the trainers at that time. And I'll never forget when I got Lafitte, he was doing 15, and he was in Saratoga the previous year. He wasn't in the top 10, and I had Cordero then. But weight was a big deal. If a horse got him with 10, if Dave goes all 2 pounds over, he wouldn't put Braulio Baez on or whoever it was. They wanted somebody with the weight. So I got Lafitte, and he said to us, are we going to go to New York? I said, no, we're not going to New York. He said, I was there last year. You didn't finish in the top 10. What do you mean? You were there last year. How about your weight? I said, Johnny Rotz, Braulio Baez, they're all doing 11 and 12. You're fighting to do 15. And he said, what am I going to do? I said, you can't do it. You can't make it. You're fighting now. He said, well, what weight do you think if I can make it? I said, okay, if you make 13, we'll go. And he looked at me. I thought he was going to cry. And he said, 13. I said, I know you can't make it, Lafitte.
What was his day in, day out?
He was fighting to do his 15 in those days.
So now you're asking him to get
him
down two more pounds.
Because 2 pounds was a big deal, Rick. But those owners and trainers, Baez is doing 11, Cordero is doing 12, Ross is doing 11. Here he was fighting to do 15. So cut a long story short about the weight situation. So we get to Saratoga. I had him live next door to me. And my father went down to Montgomery Ward and bought a portable sauna where he could sit in that sauna with his head out and watch television from 10 o'clock until 11 o'clock. He would sit there with his wife and the baby. After he got on 8 horses in the morning, he would leave there, go to the racetrack, get on the scale. If how much he was 2 pounds, he would get a rubber suit on, run the infield on the turf course for 2 miles, get back into the jock's room, get on the scale again. If he was a pound over, then get in the hot box to do 13. He did 13 as long as I had him in New York, and he wound up the leading rider. And I said to him, you will never do 13 again as long as I'm your agent, because of the fact everybody knew then how great a rider that he was at an early age. But weight was so important for me as an agent and for you as a racing secretary.
Let me ask you, do you think that 2 pounds mattered in the whole scheme of things?
No, I don't think it did.
I'm with
you. But not going a distance to ground.
But mentally.
Mentally,
absolutely.
I agree with that, Rick. But I think going in the handicaps, 2 pounds, 3 pounds, a big deal going a mile a quarter. You know that. That was your job to separate.
We used
to sometimes you got to be a head shrinker as a racing secretary. You watch the races. And you see that jock never let him run. And you're basing that performance, how he ran, if he won by a neck. But in his heart, he knows he got to win by 10. But he's got to be easy, put 1 pound on and take one off somebody else so they will form the race. Otherwise, if he didn't do that, there would be no handicap division as we have now. Nobody wants to carry weight. I don't see any horses with 35.
No.
So my times, I'm happy to have been involved in that. But today to be a racing secretary, it's so much easier than Rick's time when he had all that pressure with the handicap division.
Who among jocks that are not, you know, not household names or Hall of Famers. I mean, who had great talent that you know, injuries or you know, their size, they outgrew. Who comes to mind that I
remember in my days when Belmont Park had 2-year-old races right down the infield. They'd have 24 horses, and there were certain jocks that were outstanding 2-year-old riders. And at that time, he was a part Indian, was named Jimmy Nichols. He was the champion 2-year-old. For some reason, he was very tall, and he won all the 2-year-old races. But that's just one of those crazy things.
Well, Jimmy Nichols, if I'm not mistaken, that's Clocker John's...
Related to him?
Yeah, that's Clocker John's,
he's
I want to say, great uncle, I think, right?
Yes.
And what time is it? It's 10:15, so John's probably still clocking or they're just wrapping up.
That's John's great uncle. At 2-year-olds, he specialized in them. I don't know why, but he won most of the photo finishes. Good 2-year-old riders got the job done. And just like you're only going 2 furlongs, 3 furlongs. But they got to be like a quarter horse jock when they come out of the chute. But he was probably the best 2-year-old jock that I was around. And R. Carroll said he was the best. I spent a lot of time with Eddie in the house all the time. I listened to anything he had to say because I understood. He was called the master in those days.
What on the Arcaro subject?
Eric Guerin was another.
Eric Guerin.
He had so much problem with weight, but he was big guy, big shoulders, and he had trouble pulling pounds off. And he was an outstanding. He rode Native Dancer. He won 30 races, I think, on that horse. But he never had an opportunity because a lot of races he couldn't ride in because he couldn't do the weight. He was doing 15 lengths like Lafitte. But most of the horses got in with 10 and 11. You know that, Rick.
What's the lowest weight you ever saw somebody run in a big race?
105, 106 pounds.
Yeah.
Once in a while, you saw a lightweight horse that happened to beat the good horses, Rick.
Right.
But then most of the jocks couldn't do the weight.
Right.
So they're always 2 or 3 pounds overweight. If they got in with 6, they carried 9.
Who's the best lightweight rider ever?
Best lightweight
Shoemaker.
Rider? Who?
Yeah.
Shoemaker. That I thought... you know, Johnny Ross was outstanding. He was cool. He wasn't a flashy guy. But somehow, when he got to that wire, he was there. Claudio Baez was never my good buddy today, but he was very stonewall, never say nothing. And he was get the job done at the wire. But then I was fortunate enough to work with a Cordero who was speed, and he dropped it on you in a second. If you tried to get through, he'd drop you. He didn't care. But that was Angel. Then I got Pinkay as the complete opposite. Big and powerful, strong. And he beats you at the wire, puts the stick down. And then I got Chris McCarron. He was a tactician, as I called. He had a little bit of Cordero and a little bit of Pinkay, but he had the knowledge up there. He won a lot of races using his cabeza, if we say. he didn't have to have brute strength. He'd outfox another jock, put him in a bind, and make the right move and leave him there and win the races. So I was fortunate from speed jock, come behind jock, and having Cordero and Pinkay and McCarron. I've had 10 Hall of Fame jocks, and one more is going to go in as Joel Rosario, and that'll be my last. And I talk to Joel every day. How's me brother? How am I doing? And I likes to see me watch him ride, and I give him my opinion, and I'm very proud of that. He's 39 now.
Is he that old?
Yeah, he's 39.
I mean, he's not that old. That old. Who listen to this?
When he lived with me in 2007, he didn't talk much English, and now he talks English. He writes, and I'm proud of that. But he's an outstanding jockey. He's good as anybody.
You have a lot of East Coast stories. When did you come? When did you decide to pack the bags and come west and stay west? Octavio.
There's Octavio Vergara.
Big jacket you have in your Cordero.
Oh, here we go.
So that rider you have in your life in the
there
river.
We go.
Okay?
Everybody gets on me.
He never had you, Octavio?
Oh, he had me.
Yeah, I had him too. I had him.
He beat away. He won a champion 40%. I said, good for you, Vicente. He's the great agent. Yeah. He like Frank Sinatra. He can once 100 years.
Very good, Octavio.
Octavio Vergara weighing in.
It's just horse racing, man. Once you get involved with it, it's not only the horses, it's the people that you're working with. And nothing more than being around people. They don't need a lot of money to be happy. The horses make them happy. And just to go around the barn area, see how great they're being treated, and yet to see people distort the truth in the papers, the horses are being abused and all that. Come back to the and look one day for yourself. But I'm just proud to be part of the game, and as an old man now, it's okay. I've had my glory days, and there's great trainers and great horses. I've been halfway around the world. Never would have happened. I mean, I went to Caracas, Venezuela. And in those days, you always went with your jockey. And it was kind of a situation. Lafitte's now on top. And I met this guy in Belmont Park. And he said to me, you know, Lafitte's father's riding in Caracas, Venezuela. And they want him to go over and ride against his father. I said, I don't know if we got time to do that. So one thing led to another. A couple of days ago, when he came up, I'm sitting in the box. He said, I just talked to Lafitte. I said, yeah, what happened? And he says, Lafitte said he's going to go to Caracas, Venezuela. He's not going anywhere. The guy said, what? What? I said, he's not going anywhere. He said, but I just talked to him. You go back in town, tell him I said he's not going anywhere. How much money did you offer him anyway? He said, $5,000. Tell him he's not going. He looked at me like I was crazy. He went back down to see Lafitte. He came back up. He said, Lafitte said, you're the boss. I told you that. You don't have to go down there. I said, you want him to go for nothing. I said, I'll tell you what we'll do. You come up with $10,000 in cash. He's not going to come out of that jock's room until you get $10,000 to his wife. And then you're going to pay for the airplane over. And we want a private car with a bodyguard. Or he said, they're not going to go for that. I said, well, he's not going to be there either. A couple of days go by, and he comes back. He said, they said, okay. Oh, really? So we got there. We spent a week. It was beautiful. That's when the track was outstanding. The government owned the track. So I'm upstairs, and now Lafitte's in the jock room, and no money showing up. And the guy at the first race went by, and she's sitting in the window. I said, Linda, I ain't not going to let him come out of that room. See, we come a long way. I said, I don't care. We're not moving. The next race, the guy come by. I said, where's the money for the jock? She's got a pocketbook here, but there's no money in there. So he said, I'll be right back. I said, Pinkay ain't coming out of that jock's room. He ain't coming out of that jock's room until the money shows up. Well, cut a long story short, the money showed up. Lafitte rode 3 winners that day. Now, we're all happy. We get in the airport, Rick, and now we're waiting to leave. To come back out of the country. And the next thing is they said, you can't leave. What do you mean we can't leave? They said, he didn't pay his taxes. Pay what taxes? He said he won 3 races today. They don't know about the $10,000 we got, see? I had about to tell them. I said, so listen, Pinkay donated that money to the jocks room. You call the jocks room, and then we'll... let us leave here. It's like we're not going to get out of Pensacola. Well, I'm Mr. McAnally. See you later, Ron.
Bye, hey, Ron.
So, cut long story short, they finally let us out of there. Yeah, Mac. So I finally, they let us out of there. I said, Lafitte, I ain't never coming back for another thing. There ain't no chance. They were going to let us out of here, and they invited us there. So that
yeah,
was
Vinny was, Vinny was, if you don't, Vinny is a, he's not a small man, so not many people argued with Vinny. He had a good left
well,
hook.
I fought as a middleweight when I was a young guy, 160 pounds. And the craziest thing now, Tommy just died. Tommy Gambino, his father was a godfather. Tommy was my goombad, my pal. And everybody got away from me in New York. Every time, no matter where I went, nobody played around. And he just died 3 months ago. Vinny's
a well-respected coast to coast. And, you know, one thing that I always liked about that what Vinny did handled with his riders, when they got days, guess what? What did they do?
They took them. Never did I appeal days. And I told the stewards, whatever the situation happens, I don't care if he's got a big horse to ride in another stake race. And the jock said, well, we're going to appeal. You better get another agent. You're not going to appeal. I said, it's not going to happen. Morning, Paul. It's not going to happen. I said, furthermore, when you get suspended, you're the one that made the problem. I didn't make it. So therefore, you're going to suffer the consequences. The more you get days, the more you're going to sit down, and you're not going to ride in the big races. So that kind of changed their attitude. They never thought about appealing days anymore. So I always told that to the stewards. I respect their decision. Sometimes you disagree with them, but that's life. You know, the guy that invented the pencil with that eraser, he was pretty smart guy, because we all make mistakes, and you can go in there and erase that mistake.
But I love it.
As an agent, you got a jock. You know, you got big races coming up. He's got to understand, don't take those chances, and think about a week from now, or 2 weeks, what the big races are. Sometimes you have to lose a race, do the best you can, but don't be careless in your riding. And most jocks today, they want to win so bad, they cause a lot of problems. And the major problem is, as the situation, they have to respect each other. Those rules are to keep them from going down, sure, from not falling, you know, and to protect each other. And that's what I tell them. You want to win the race bad enough? Would you feel better if you dropped that guy and he's out of action for 6 months? Well, would you like that? No. So be more careful.
Well, Vince, out of curiosity, and I don't know how much you have followed this, but Jose Santos' son.
Oh, yes. He comes to see me all the time.
Well, and he's created with you know, yeah, the advent of the the computer draw and being able to represent jocks in multiple jurisdictions. What he's crafted is remarkable.
It's kind of odd. He comes to see me all the time. He knows what I've done in the past with all the jocks I've had. And I looked at him and I said, how did you come up with this idea? Because normally a jockey does not want you to do business on the telephone. They want you to go to the barns with him and listen to the trainer, what he has to say, in retrospect. So now he's probably got 6 jockeys around
more.
The country.
Yep.
And the trainers, more or less today, because of the modern technology with the cell phone, the trainer doesn't want you at the barn and bothering him. He feels better to text you and do his business.
Yep.
And if he had to talk to you momentarily on the phone, they'll handle it today. But years ago, you couldn't get away with that.
Well, the advent of COVID
contributed
heavily to this, and Jose took advantage of it, saw an opening where the draw was done in the racing office every day. And on one side of the counter was the office, and the other side of the counter were the agents. Would be a 10, 15, 20 agents out there. And to me, that was actually one of the funnest parts of the whole day, was watching the...
Well, how it's operation.
How the operation and the comments going on back and forth. Once in a while, it would get heated. There would be a little, you know, maybe a little pushing and shoving, but not bad. But I enjoyed that interaction between agents in the office and each other and going back and forth. So when COVID came, of course, we couldn't have people in a certain amount of people in a closed area. Mm-hmm. So the idea was, well, we'll just do the draw over the phone. we'll put the, this is even before Zoom. So we'd put the, just to put the phone down by the receiver and everybody be listening on the other end. And so Jose said, well, let's get me, let me get this straight here. Can't go to the track, so let me try and do this, that, and the other. So he ended up, as Steve mentioned, you know, a couple track, couple agents at Fairgrounds. I mean, a couple riders at Fairgrounds, a couple at Oaklawn, because he was at Oaklawn at the time. And I was watching his operation. A very smart kid. I can call him a kid now. And I just morphed into that. And to this day, I don't think there's a track around that makes the agents be at the draw again. And I really miss that part of the action. But so there's no draw. A lot of it's done on Zoom. They'll just put a camera there, and they'll, you know, number four, and they'll name the horse and name the rider. And if there's a situation, the agent will just go, hey, no, I'm supposed to ride that one and put, you know, put whoever
we
on.
We miss that. I do personally, to be there when they draw the races. But now the situation, as you just mentioned, Rick, with the fact that we have all the technology that we, an owner or a trainer can call in to hear the draw, see what post position he got, what jockey's available, if another guy takes off his horse, who's available, and the agent on the other end say, so-and-so's open, so-and-so's open, so right away we're going to handle that situation within 5 minutes, that those horses are all going to have a jockey on them. Before, when Jockey No Boy, that was a headache. You had to go track the trainer down and to see if you can ride the horse in the afternoon. And New York would be No Boys. No Boy, No Boy. And if you didn't get there early and an agent got to the office early, he's calling that trainer. And by the time you get there and you look, No Boy's already taken place.
That was when, because I lived through this back in the East. You were only as good as your phone list.
Correct.
And in the afternoon, if you didn't know where, you know, Butch Reed ate lunch, you could call the place where he ate lunch, and you go, whoever got him first got the mount.
Correct.
And so now, of course,
now it's easy. You're on
everyone. Everyone's connected.
But years ago, without that, Rick, when a horse was open, you had to run to the barn to get the trainer to get him permission to name on that horse.
Yeah, so it's just a lot different, and that's the interactions of the people that I miss, which they were part of the game.
We all missed going to the draw.
Right?
All of us do.
Yeah, and so
nobody goes there.
No, because the steward,
I mean, they send out a notice, and in 20 minutes we're going to draw. You have the free number and the code, and you call in.
Yeah.
Pretty soon you're waiting for them, and boom, everybody's right there. And then they start drawing. You hear the post position, and so-and-so needs a rider, so-and-so. And then it's quiet. And now the agents are trying to figure out, can that horse run to my open? Oh, then they'll say, oh, I'm open, so-and-so. Otherwise, they don't say nothing. They know the horse is not that good. You don't hear a peep out of it. Nobody.
Well, the only similar scenario now is really when there's a claimant, when there's a shake, that when the trainers come in, you know, to shake for horses. That's the last remnant of that.
That's a good point. You know, there'd be three or four. I mean, when I left Oaklawn, there could be 5, 10, 15, 20 people there, and they'd be waiting out front for the magical number to come up and see if it was they could walk away with a slip.
Well, and the betting game that goes on when there's a, you know, well, that's harmless. That's not anything you know, when they each the you know, they each of the when there's a 6 or 7 in on a draw, you know, on a shake, and they each put they'll each put 20 up, and whoever, you know, not only do you get the horse, but you get the 20s.
So getting back to
more.
Jose Santos, it's easy for him to be at home and call that number, and if he's keeping records of a horse that's in the condition book, he knows when he's open and when he's not open for whatever rider that he may have open. So that's the only reason he can get away with that,
well,
because of technology.
Look, he works for the jock. If the jock's not happy, they're going to let him do it. But obviously, he's got this system down. He was the first one. We talked to him a couple years ago at Oakland. He was kind of just getting started. And, you know, he enters a lot of horses. He's got everything.
He knows what horses are going in.
So.
That's a big edge.
Yeah, so.
You've got to remember, in my days, you can only have one older rider and one apprentice jockey at that meeting. Now he can have 5 or 6 jockeys, but they're all not at the same meeting. But if all those guys showed up, he can't be an agent only for 2 of them.
That's generally the rule around the country. You get two riders and maybe an apprentice as well, if depending on the circuit.
So and a full-fledged jockey. But in my days, you can only have one or the other.
Right.
And for years, that rule never changed.
No.
And when I had Pinkay, they come to me with Pat Valenzuela. Well, if he said, you got to spend time with me. So you can't just try to expand your business. And I understood that, what the situation is.
You said that's something interesting. If you take on, the apprentice, and when the apprenticeship is over, and if your main journeyman,
you have to give him up.
You've got to give him
up. But one of them,
not now.
Not now. But back then, and was there sort of a farm system where if you know somebody like you who was the leading agent of the day? And you brought along an apprentice, and you would feed him in somebody's direction.
Correct.
And a farm system. It's a shark system.
But you know what happened a lot of time when you got an old rider like a Pinkay, and you got an apprentice jock, his job is to take them the mounts off, the weight off them horses, and now I got Pinkay heavy, and the trainer said, let's put the bug on. Pretty soon you got problem now with Pinkay. What are you taking me off that horse for? Because of the weight situation. But today we don't have an apprentice jockey here right now.
There's nobody here in the colony?
Not one right here, none. So therefore all the jocks are happy about it. They know once their bug boy comes, a lot of them horses are gonna lose. But no bug boys there now. Think about it.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
That's true.
Well, you had the last several winters. You had some good, particularly some good female riders, right?
The last one we had was Tori Alba. Things got a little rough here this winter, and he got upset. He wanted to ride five or six more, so they called him. He's doing terrific in Lowell, Maryland right now. But he was here. But he realized the bug is going in May. He loses his apprenticeship allowance if he doesn't take advantage of it now. And when comes May, he's no longer a bug. Now his business is going to change.
That's another follow-up. Vince DeGregory is with us. For those that have never heard Vince, the rest of you knew immediately who you were listening to. Who else among, you mentioned young Santos, but who else over the years, Vince, did you help cultivate and get their careers started as jock agents?
Oh, so many agents through the years have come to me and asked me different things and how I handle them, and that's quite a nice honor that you can help somebody else. I remember when I was struggling, I hung around Vic Gilardi. God bless Vic.
Yep.
He's the one that saved me as an agent, and I was in Florida struggling, broke, and he called me. He said, Vince, what's happening? And I said, I'm here. It's 80 degrees. I said, where are you? He said, I'm in Bowie. It's 30 degrees. Wow. He said, you making any money? No. He said, listen, I got Phil Grimm. He's the leading jock. I got the bug boy, Kenny Baker. Come up here, and you get I'll give you the bug boy. Are you crazy? It's 30 degrees over here. He says to me, you got any money in your pocket? No. Well, then you better come up here. So I went there. Now, this is ironic that I can tell this story. So when I got there and freezing, he said to me, you got to go to my motel with me. I want to show you how to be an agent. What do you mean to show me how to be an agent? You got a pen? You got a condition book? He said, that isn't how the game works. I didn't know better, Rick. So I go to his motel. I go and open the door. He's got the telegraphs all over the floor. I said, hey, what are you doing? How sloppy are you? He said, that's money there. What money? He said to me, you got to learn to find the horses. That's what it is to be a good agent. You got to separate one horse from the other. So he's the one enlightened me about that situation. And as it turned out, as God bless his soul, that he had, when I got to New York, he had Georgie Velasquez. After, he had Chop Chop, who's now up for the award for the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
And he helped him be who he was. And I went and I dethroned him with Cordero, and then I went back and I beat him with Pinkay. And then this insult in 1980, I went back to New York with Chris McCarron, and they looked at me and they said, What are you doing with that guy here? You got two champions, Cordero and Pinkay. What are you going to do with him here? What do you mean, what am I going to do with him? This guy's got talent. Just needs an opportunity to show his talent. So Vic said to me, you got another one, huh? That's what he said to me, Vic. Well, I'll cut a long story short. Chris not only led the nation in winners that year, 1980, with 405 winners, he led the nation in the money title. So when I got through, Vic Gilardi came to me and said, I got to take you out for dinner. For what? He said, just to salute you, that I had something to do with your career, that you become a great agent, and I just want to have dinner with you. I don't know if I'll see you again. And then later on after that, he got sick, and then Vic died. So as a young agent, I thought I knew everything. I didn't know anything. But there's always somebody would teach you. And so I got happy to teach so many agents today. And Ron Anderson is my buddy. He's doing fantastic. He was here when I was on top, and he used to be working in the mutuals. You know, he was a seller. So all of those things, but Ronnie put his mind to it. He was gambling in those days, and he don't gamble no more. Now he's all business-minded. He's got Johnny Velasquez, and he's got Joel Rosario. Then the winner, he had Dettori here. So he was doing all his business on the phone,
yep,
which years ago, that would have never happened.
Yep.
The jocks would not allow that. They want you there because you had to be there for the draw. But like you said, Rick, we don't have to be there now. You just get on the headphones and listen to the draw. You know who's open.
Who's the toughest to work for?
Who's the toughest to work for?
Because they,
young,
can be difficult. Let's be honest.
That never made it. They're the ones that are very, like Cordero. He wanted so much to be the leading writer of America, the first one out of Puerto Rico. And always, how are we going to ride? Who's this and that? Hey, wait a minute. You hire me to be a babysitter for you, or you hire me for my knowledge of putting you on the right horses? So as it turned out, in 1968, he led the nation in winners. And I was very, very fortunate that the governor of Puerto Rico had a special day for all of the outstanding athletes out of Puerto Rico or whatever field they were involved in. So I went over to Puerto Rico, and I have a picture in my phone today. I'll never forget that picture. And there was Eddie Belmonte and Angel Cordero for the jockeys. Next to me was Chichi Rodriguez for golf.
Nice.
Then was my good buddy Orlando Cepeda, who played for the Giants.
Cepeda.
And on the far end, Roberto Clemente. That was just before he got in the plane and lost his life. So that is a part of my life that I'll never forget. The people that I wind up being with that are famous in the sports industry.
Well, I mean, if we're going to go in this direction, you can talk not just about sports stars, but you dated starlets and movie stars. And
oh, that's another.
You rubbed elbows with everybody in Hollywood. Who are you kidding?
It's funny you say that because when I was a kid, I used to go every Saturday, see the Cowboys and everybody perform and the movie actors. I come to California, God bless him. I was sitting in the box. I knew who he was, Burt Bacharach. He was sitting next to me, and I'm there sitting with Tommy Doyle, and I'm not about to say hello. I'm very shy about that. And he's talking to everybody. Finally got up, he said, I'm going to go get some hot dogs. Would you like a hot dog? I'm looking at him. Are you talking to me? He said, your name's Vince DiGregory, isn't it? Yes. He said, I'm Burt Bacharach. I said, oh, I know who you are. So that's how we met. And from that time on, I lived on the Hollywood Side Towers right above where he used to record A&M Records, two blocks from where I lived. So then he said to me, why don't you come down for the recording studio? We're going to cut some records. So I go there. Who's there? The Carpenters were just new. They were recording, and I met Dionne Warwick. And from one to the next, and anything, Jack Klugman's my good buddy, Walter Matthau. We're going to put you in the movies. Movies? I'm no movie actor. Yeah. I'm a jockey agent. Oh, we got some parts. I told you, I'm not a movie actor. I'm a jockey agent. And from one to another, Angie Dickinson. Angie's a sweetheart. She's my friend. So I went from one to another. Next thing, I'm with Saratoga in 1968 with Cordero. I met John Forsythe, and he was just starting to be famous. And he was very good friends with Laz Barrera. And he took a liking to me. He said, Vince, you're going to come with me. And where are we going, John? So we're going to California. California? Where the hell is California? I thought it was around the other end of the world. No airplanes flying. I said, what are we going to do in California? He said, I'm going to be your agent. Me? Doing what? So I'm going to make a movie star. You movie star? Are you crazy? I'm a jock's agent. I got Cordero. Cut a long story. Now he all of a sudden he gets Charlie's Angels, blah, blah, blah. Now John is exploding. Now I'm head of the Jockey Agents Guild, so we decided to honor Klugman, which we did, now honoring John Forsythe. So who wound up being on the appearance with me under John Forsythe was he just died. He's an MC with me, and so we're presenting the award to John Forsythe. So I said, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. What an honor it is for me to be here and for so many people to come to honoring John Forsythe. I'd like to tell you a little story, how I met John Forsythe, which I just told you about it, and then they started laughing. I said, it's quite odd that John Forsythe wanted me to be a movie actor. Oh, they were roaring, right? That that was all to put on. So and finally, John grabs the microphone. He said, excuse me. He's telling you the true story. I was so much impressed with the way he handled himself. He'd been a great movie actor. Then I grabbed the microphone. I said, John, isn't the best thing happened? You wouldn't be honored tonight, neither would I be who I am, if I listened to that nonsense of being a movie star. But that's...
Well, I'll put up a picture today. I'll put up a picture today that will show why they wanted to make you a movie star, because you had movie star looks, and you know that's a
very,
fact.
Very blessed behind that. Well, but just a funny story about it.
Tremendous. Mean, you just listen. If you listen to Vinny, you can see the attraction and why you would. Anybody would want to be associated with him, especially around the racetrack. And like I said, he didn't take any guff from anybody regarding anything. He took care of his job, took care of his jocks.
Yeah.
There's my man, Sal.
Racing's been good to me, Rick.
Yeah, and it's been good to all of us. That's why we're still here.
Today, people say, how come you're always so nice to us? But my dad said to me, Vince, it doesn't cost anything to be nice to anybody. And the funniest thing about it, my name is not DeGregory. You know, that's the name that my parents wound up with. But when I was a little kid, I said to my grandfather, Grandpa, am I Italian? He said, yes. Are you Italian? I'm coming from Naples. I said, well, where's DeGregory? Where did that come from? He said, son, listen to me. When I come here in 1924, when the Depression, I could not get a job. He lived in New York City. He said, I changed the name from DeGregorio to DeGregory, then American name, I got a job. So I kept DeGregory. My tomb, when I was born, I'm DeGregorio. I already had my tombstone next to my dad. It's Vincenzo DeGregorio. That's my real name. I'm proud of who I was. But I understand my grandparents, they couldn't get a job, so they changed the name. So DeGregory, everybody knows me.
Well, obviously, you're not the only one. And I got to have you. Every time, 90% of the time when I see Vinny, if he's wearing a hat, he's got the Bonnie Akers hat. Explain the Bonnie Akers.
Bobby Mitchell called me the other day.
Right.
Not doing too well right now.
Okay.
But he's got the farm over in Hemet, and he always calls me, how's my buddy doing? So I'm very happy that he still remembers me. He's 94, I think, now. So my travels and meeting so many wonderful people has been my enjoyable part of my career. Bobby Hatfield with the Righteous Brothers. He used to sit next to me, his wife, in Hollywood Park. And he said to me, Vince, this is ironic, though. He said to me, Vince, do you have a contract with Pinkay? No, jockeys don't have contracts. He said to me, you know, you might get fired. What are you going to do when you get fired? What are you talking about, get fired? He's the leading jockey in America. He ain't going to fire me. He said, just think about it. He could fire you tomorrow. What are you talking about that for? He said, here's what you ought to do. You take me, the Righteous Brothers were on top. All the famous groups. He said, you be the business manager, have your own desk, and you don't need no jockeys. Are you crazy? You give up horse racing?
No.
To sit in the desk 8 hours a day?
No, not when you can come out here.
That ain't going to happen.
No.
To honor the story, the next year, He comes to the racetrack, and I was fired by Pinkay. I said, Jesus, look at this crazy shit.
But what did you do? You got another. You got another.
You did all right. Okay. Yeah, you did
but
all
that's
right.
That's crazy about life.
It is.
He's, no, you be us. You be our manager. No, I ain't going to leave the racetrack.
And you still are, and you're still here all these
and
years
that was
later.
1974.
Unbelievable.
So
unbelievable.
I can tell you stories of so many people. The Righteous Brothers were a big hit.
Sure. Sure.
But
I got to take the break.
Okay.
And speaking of agents, the guy, Jeff Franklin. Crafty,
hey,
Jeff Franklin.
Long time no see, Jeff. Wow. Good seeing you, buddy.
We'll take the break here. Vince, thanks so much.
I'm happy to come by. You take care of everything in Greenwich, will you, please?
I will. Back after this.
Come on, Jeff.